rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Ead, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three matters on our oral argument calendar today, October 11, 2023. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
Case number A221734, State of Minnesota versus Romando Walker.
Counsel, just a refresher on the rules. You each have 15 minutes. There is a timer on the podium that will show you where you're at on that time. 5 minutes is reserved to you, appellant counsel, if you choose to use that for rebuttal purposes. Please state your name and the individual you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. You can probably also tell my voice is a little nasal. I'm trying not to mask because I'll be garbled, but if so, I will do that. And thank you for being here today.
Should I begin then?
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Greg Scanlon, and I represent appellant Romando Walker. Mr. Walker is asking this court to reverse his convictions for aggravated robbery and second-degree assault because the dangerous weapon element was not proven. He otherwise asks this court to give him a new trial because his attorney impermissibly conceded the dangerous weapon element. This is not a case of first impression. Minnesota courts have long understood how ordinary items like knives fit within the legislature's definition of dangerous weapon. Like many everyday items, a knife is typically found to be a dangerous weapon based on the manner it is used or intended to be used. A knife is only designed as a weapon when there is something specific about the knife that makes it uniquely capable of inflicting bodily harm. Our Supreme Court has helped solidify this notion recently by analyzing what the word design means. In State v. Douglas, the Supreme Court applied the definition of design in a criminal case involving use of aluminum foil to commit shoplifting.
That case was markedly different. I sat on that particular case at the appellate level, and you know they were altering what the device was by applying that. So doesn't that seem to be very different than what we have here, where the item was as it was?
Well, it is, and I only highlight it to point out that specific distinction. Because Douglas talks about, we look at the way either a manufacturer designs something, but we also talk about how an individual might design it. And there are knife cases that fall under both categories. You look at a case like State v. Quimby, where the knife was, the manufacturer put a groove in the blade of the knife, a blood groove, to make it more dangerous because it makes a person bleed more. But then you see someone like State v. Henderson, that's a patient in a mental hospital who took an ordinary ballpoint pen and sharpened it and made a shiv or a shank out of it so that he could stab someone with it. And so, yes, design can be either the way the manufacturer made it or the way the defendant makes it. There's another case, KME, I believe, where a person actually fashioned their own knife out of sheet metal. And it was built somewhat like a hunting knife, except they had what the court called, fashioned what the court called an industrial-sized razor blade, double-sided as the blade. And so the court said, he designed a weapon. It's not just a knife, but he actually designed it to be a weapon.
Is it your position that there needed to be specific testimony regarding the design of the knife or specific evidence submitted, including perhaps an expert opinion? Or would you agree that the jury could determine that the knife in question was designed as a weapon based on all of the evidence that was submitted to it?
I think when it's an everyday item, when it's a knife, when it's a paperclip, when it's a cotton ball, or if they're going to say that it's designed as a weapon, if that's the only thing they're relying on to prove the element, it's like any other element. They have to prove it sufficiently. And no, I don't think the average juror knows enough about the design of a knife. I mean, a buck knife is designed differently than a knife that a carpenter or an electrician uses.
So which will we be beholding then, if we agree with you, that in every case in which the jury is to determine whether something is designed as a dangerous weapon, that requires expert testimony?
Not necessarily expert testimony. In some of the cases, the deputy testifies about the knife and what he knows about knives from his experience as a police officer. In SML, the 2006 case, I believe, an officer testified in that case, but they didn't find that officer's testimony sufficient. It wouldn't always have to be an expert. I mean, in Douglas, somebody from an aluminum foil manufacturer testified. And certainly in the case where a defendant designs it himself, I don't know that certainly an expert or even a police officer could say why that knife is particularly dangerous and why it goes beyond what an ordinary knife is.
But someone would need to say, in your view, there need to be a witness that would say this is designed as a weapon.
I think so, just because it's a term of art. I mean, again, before Douglas, there wasn't really a specific definition, but we do have a specific definition. There has to be a special intentional adaptation of that knife. And so, I mean, the state has the burden, and so they can decide what they want to put on as proof or not. And it may be some things are obviously designed as a weapon, a hand grenade, for instance.
My recollection is the state had the knife there, and then there was a photo that went back to the jury, right? So the jury got to see.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So what are you saying is missing from their evidence, or maybe I misunderstood your statement? You were saying the state could put evidence in as they want, and you're arguing sufficiency of the evidence. What more could have been done? I mean, the jury was able to see and hear the testimony.
Well, what I'm saying is that this knife is not designed as a weapon. There wasn't anything they could have put in. I mean, maybe there is that. I pointed out in my brief that there's some weird nibs on the blade. I don't know what that is. If that is specifically designed to make that more dangerous, more likely, more capable of inflicting bodily harm, somebody could have testified about that. Maybe an officer would recognize, has seen knives that like that before. Certainly a manufacturer.
What about the victim's testimony that he was concerned that he was going to be stabbed, that he was fearful because of how this knife appeared to him? Why isn't that circumstantial evidence that this was designed to be dangerous?
Well, so that the fear is the fear element of the assault element. Okay, so
well, but the fact that, I mean, he wasn't coming at him with a butter knife, right? I mean, what isn't there some relevance to the victim's testimony about the nature of this item, that its nature scared him and thought he was going to be stabbed?
Well, but certainly that would go to how it's used. If he stabs me with it, I mean, even the most ordinary harmless knife, a Swiss Army knife, is dangerous if you use it to stab somebody. That's a different definition.
I think Judge Berkman's question is more toward why can't evidence of the circumstances of its use and the manner in which it be used be circumstantial evidence of its design?
Because I think design is something different. And in fact, those are two different definitions, and the other part of the definition is different as well. When something is designed as a weapon, it's a lot easier to prove that it's a dangerous weapon. You only have to prove that it's capable of great bodily harm or death, not calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death. It only has to be capable. So once it's designed as a weapon, doesn't matter what he does with it. If it's designed as a weapon, he can keep it in his pocket and it's still a dangerous weapon. But when we're talking about something that doesn't have that special intentional adaptation, there's no evidence in this case of a special intentional adaptation. It's an everyday knife. I mean, the other danger is that if this knife, without any proof of a special intentional adaptation, is a dangerous weapon, then the sky's the limit. Every knife that every electrician carries with him, camper, fisherman, every knife that everybody has in any situation is a dangerous weapon and is designed as a weapon, and that's not the law.
Your position is that we should not consider the way in which the knife was used in determining whether there was sufficient, the evidence of the way in which it was used in determining whether there was sufficient evidence of its design?
And so, no, I don't think you should, and I don't think it's capable of doing that, because we have a very specific definition of what design means. I don't think it's within the average juror to know what the design of this particular knife is, of everyday knives is. They probably would agree if it was a chef's knife, it's designed to, like, chop potatoes, right? I mean, if that's their common, that's their working background knowledge of knives, then that isn't sufficient, because it's designed for cutting food.
Let me ask you, why shouldn't we look at the entire statutory definition? Your argument is towards the definition that was submitted to the jury, which was towards its design, but are we on a sufficiency review precluded from considering the evidence that went to the jury that would fit under the use or intended use definition?
I think that violates the right to a jury determination of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. My client didn't waive a jury determination that every element was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And this, with all due respect, this isn't a jury. If they weren't asked that, and this is Moss, right? State v. Moss. State v. Moss is a very easy case if they rely on bodily harm, because the victim of that aggravated robbery was harmed. But what the court says is neither party, it wasn't presented to the jury as a bodily injury case. That's a very easy case if it's bodily injury, because bodily injury establishes an aggravated robbery in the same way that a dangerous weapon does. And they said, but we cannot decide based on injury, because that wasn't presented to the jury. I also cited the ordinance case about nuisance, where they say that when you're reviewing for sufficiency, you rely on what the jury was instructed on. And I don't think that was a jury case, because it was an ordinance, but I also cite that language from Justice Scalia in a different context. I think it's very dangerous to start making findings on the Court of Appeals that a jury didn't find, wasn't asked to find, couldn't possibly have found. My other position is that this wasn't a dangerous weapon in the manner it was used or intended to be used. If all you do is hold a knife 3 feet away from somebody, that has zero likelihood of causing any bodily harm. What we're actually talking about is intended use. What you would have to find is that Mr. Walker intended to use the knife in a way that was calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death. And so you would have to find, so first of all, it would have to be circumstantial evidence, standard of review. Moss is sort of notorious because that was at a time when it wasn't clear that we applied that in an intended use case or an intent case. But you would have to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, or find that the only reasonable inference is that he intended to actually physically assault the victim with that knife.
But it would be your position that holding a knife and telling someone to give them their shoes, if we set aside any inconsistencies in circumstantial evidence, that that's not sufficient evidence under the circumstantial standard of an intent to cause fear in order to take property from someone?
It's absolutely intent to cause fear. That's the assault element. That's the robbery, I'm getting your stuff element. We're talking about the dangerous weapon element. Causing fear, that's not the definition of dangerous weapon. The intended use, for it to be a dangerous weapon, the intended use has to be calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death. And in the assault, with the assault charge in particular, he obviously intended to cause fear. But the inference is reasonable that he only intended to cause fear. Remember, the victim came at him and shoved him. He had every opportunity. If he intended to stab him or slice him or cut him, he would have. It's hard to get to where that's the only reasonable inference, that he actually intended to cause bodily harm. If you're not doing anything or intending to do anything where the knife comes in contact with the victim, then there's no calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death.
Wouldn't that position mean that you could never be convicted of a second degree assault if you didn't actually hurt someone with the weapon?
No, there are lots of ways you can prove intent. I have another case that's before the Supreme Court right now where a guy is holding a board and he says, I'm going to beat you with it. He uses vulgar terms, but and so the question is, well, isn't that intent? I mean, if he's standing there holding a board and he says he's going to hit you with it, and that's a pretty solid case for intent. I don't know if we're going to win that one or not. I mean, even circumstantially, but he didn't do anything with the board. But yeah, I mean, that's the problem with intent is that we have to look at all the evidence and decide whether that intent is there. And I do think it's I think it's always going to be difficult to prove a second degree assault. Fear, second degree assault harm is easy. Second degree assault fear is always going to be hard because there's always going to be, if he doesn't do anything with the weapon, it's going to be hard because you can always, there's always going to be a possibility of an inference that he didn't actually mean. I mean, people, maybe he only intended to cause fear. It looks like this guy only intended to cause fear. He was hoping that just showing the knife would get in the shoes. And the guy resisted and shoved him, and he still didn't do anything with the knife. I think the intent is clear, or the inference, the reasonable inference is clear that he never intended to stab him or slice him or cut him. But again, that's and to answer your broader question, remember that this only happens with things that aren't a firearm, aren't designed as a weapon, and aren't used in a dangerous way. We're just in.
But why isn't this used in a dangerous way when you have opening up this knife that's 7 to 10 inches long and lunging at the victim? Why isn't the manner in which that is used such that it makes it a dangerous
weapon?
I'm
sorry, I misspoke. When I say dangerous, I mean with intended use. When I say danger, I mean calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death. That's what we mean when we say dangerous and when we're talking about an everyday item, an item that's not designed as a weapon and not a firearm.
Why isn't it likely to cause great bodily harm or death to hold a 7 to 10 inch knife 3 feet away from someone and where the person is so provoked they get up and push you and walk away? Seems like a likely situation where someone might get stabbed.
Well, it depends on what calculated or likely means. If I don't do anything, we're talking about actual use now. If I stand this far away from you, If I stand this far away from someone and hold a knife, and that's the only use that I put that knife to, there's no likelihood of causing bodily harm. If he comes at me, then my use is I'm stabbing, I'm slashing, I'm doing something to bring the knife into contact with his body.
Your time has expired. I just want to remind you of that, unless you have not fully answered Judge Eade's question.
No, that's fine.
You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, State of Minnesota. The state is not here arguing that the knife is per se a dangerous weapon. And the standard of review here is not de novo. This is a sufficiency appeal from a jury verdict. The jury had the knife. The jury had the instruction. The jury was shown photos of the knife. And the prosecutor argued that he used the knife in exactly the manner that the statute requires. Under the direct evidence standard of review, that is more than sufficient to sustain the verdict under those circumstances. And this court reached that conclusion in State versus McKay in 2010 and in State versus Bloom in 2006, both unpublished opinions.
Counsel for appellant asserts that you need to have a witness testify that the design of a particular item makes it a dangerous weapon. How do you respond to that?
No case has ever held that, and in fact, it's rejected that, saying that wouldn't be helpful because the police officer's testimony, and that was, I forget the initials of the case, but Judge Ross's unpublished decision, that a police officer in that case wouldn't be helpful to the jury. So you don't need expert testimony, and you don't need to have...
You need some kind of testimony?
I think
that's the argument, that there was no witness here who said the design of this knife made it dangerous.
And McKay does not hold that and still affirmed, and Bloom does not say that and still affirmed that. And again, in this case, It's the standard of review. We're not arguing de novo where all possibilities are out there, where this knife could be used for anything. We have no idea. Under the standard of review, it's most favorable to the conviction, what the jury did. It is construing the evidence to support the verdict. It is all of these things supporting the verdict. And under the direct evidence standard of review, under McKay and Bloom, this should be affirmed on that basis. But even if you go to circumstantial evidence, you don't then throw the gates open and all everything's on the table. It's you do the circumstantial evidence standard of review. And the circumstantial evidence standard of review requires you to do two steps, right? You have to determine what are the circumstances proved. And the circumstances proved here are that he used the knife in a robbery, just like you would expect someone to use a dangerous weapon in a robbery. So this wasn't a knife normally used for butter spreading that he happened to know. Have. And we look at all these things like, well, maybe it's a fishing cutting knife.
But then you're focusing on the manner in which it's used, which the jury was not instructed to consider.
Case law from this court says that you can look to the manner it was used to determine the design. And that frankly makes sense, right? How a instrument is used can directly relate to how it was designed.
Can I ask you, you in your brief indicated that the trial counsel's concession should be considered with regard to the appellant's sufficiency challenge, but that wasn't a factual stipulation, right? There wasn't a factual stipulation submitted to the jury for the jury to consider in deciding whether or not the knife was a dangerous weapon. So aren't you really arguing for some sort of estoppel or something on appeal by making that?
No, I agree, Judge. I agree that the court shouldn't rely on that. That just was one of the facts that happened at trial, and that was how the evidence was presented.
What do you make of counsel's argument that to look at, you know, setting aside the design issue, to look at the statute and the full definition of a dangerous weapon in deciding the sufficiency issue on appeal would run afoul of Mr. Walker's Sixth Amendment rights?
I looked at the case cited by appellant's counsel, and I agree that that's what the Supreme Court did in that case. Yes. It didn't say that it was wrong to do it otherwise, but it didn't affirm on that other basis, even though it was there. So, I mean, I see the logic of the argument, but I don't see a direct holding against it.
Do you disagree, then, that the way the jury's instruction can narrow the scope of the statute if there isn't any other sort of increase in punishment by using the full element for the defendant or changing in the nature of crime or anything like that?
I agree that could be a relevant factor, certainly. But again, in this case, when we're looking at this case, we're not interpreting the statute anew. We're interpreting the statute as under the sufficiency of the evidence standard of review. And under the direct standard, it should be affirmed. And under the circumstantial evidence standard, it should certainly be affirmed.
If we conclude that the trial counsel conceded guilt, what is it in the record, in your view, that indicates that Mr. Walker consented to that concession?
Well, he did not concede guilt under Huisman, if I'm pronouncing that case probably incorrectly, from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Conceding an element, conceding an element is not conceding guilt. They are not the same. And when you look at how appellant's counsel tries to distinguish the case, it's not persuasive. I mean, it's conceding a single element is not the same as conceding guilt, and that's all that happened in this case. At the most was conceding an element. But as you point out, he didn't necessarily concede the element, and the state still had proof on it, both direct and circumstantial.
Well, he didn't stipulate to the fact, was what we were talking about earlier. But, I mean, do you agree then that he, at the very least, that he conceded an element of the offense, or did he simply concede that the knife was a weapon and then argue that Mr. Walker wasn't armed with a knife, which is the full element?
Yes, I agree. My argument is the latter.
Okay. And so if it's not, what's the state's view on if
even if it's full concession of an element, is that even ineffective assistance? Is that deficient performance?
No. On the first even day? If it was a full concession, it's not under the Supreme Court, under Huisman. But it wasn't a full concession, as you point out. Unless the court has any other questions, I would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Zettler, thank you for your time. Mr. Scanlon, you have the last word.
I'll start with Huisman. I guess that's how you say that. The court did not announce a rule that if you only concede one element, that's not ineffective assistance. They rejected both rules. The defense was saying, the state was saying you have to concede all of them, and the defense was saying, no, you can, you know, whatever. But the court says, we decline state's invitation to announce a rule of law that only a concession on each and every element of the crime is a concession of guilt. That's not the law.
But do we even have a concession on an element? What we have is defense counsel's recitation in closing about the elements of the offense, and he describes the fourth as someone being armed with a dangerous weapon, knife as a dangerous weapon. There's no concession that your client was armed with anything other than a lighter, as I recall.
Armed is a different... Well, he's armed with a dangerous weapon,
right.
So you have to prove that he's armed.
Is there a concession of that? I don't see that in the record.
A concession of the fact that he was armed?
That he was armed with a dangerous weapon.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything contesting that. I mean, the question is they have to prove that it was a dangerous weapon. And he said the knife is a dangerous weapon. They just watched a bunch of video of him with a knife. He admitted that he had a knife. That's the part.
Well, but counsel argued that he and Mr. Walker testified that he actually didn't have a knife, that he only agreed with the investigators because they were pressuring him. And so that's, I think, what Judge Bjorkman's saying, is that it was never conceded that he was armed, and the full element is armed with a dangerous weapon. So do you have a concession of an element if it's just, even if we read the closing to be that a knife is a dangerous weapon, is that a concession?
What we're talking about is effective assistance of counsel, and whether it's okay for a lawyer to concede something that had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, whether you call it an element or not, whether it's the complete element or not, he conceded something that had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury without acquiescence or permission of his client.
But what about, so let's just compare it to like being there at the casino and the date that it occurs. He never contested that. He argued that in closing. Why isn't that a concession then?
Because he didn't stand up and say, you don't have to worry about finding that he was at the casino. I'm telling you that he was at the casino. This is different. This is different. They have to decide. This is the only thing where he said, knife is a dangerous weapon. He's telling them, don't even waste your time on that. It's a dangerous weapon. And that's ineffective assistance. I did just want to talk briefly about McKay. McKay does not rely exclusively on the jury being able to determine that it's designed based on what the officer said about the knife. If that's what McKay decided, it would be it'd be a much shorter opinion. They go through all of this stuff about his bringing it to the courthouse was obviously not benign. He had some other intent, had some other purpose for bringing it there. So they're relying on his intended use. It's a manner of use case. Bloom is a manner of use case. Bloom, they say that this is the guy who's like stabbing the car seat with the knife. And they say the manner in which he wielded the knife, the manner in which, manner of use, manner of intended use, the manner in which he wielded the knife and stabbed the car seat shows that it's a dangerous weapon. That's not a design case either. It was a switchblade in that case. They probably could have relied on design, but that's not what they rely on. And if they did rely on design, guess what? A switchblade is a dangerous weapon. As far as police having to testify, PDF is the case that says you have to have proof. I'm not going to find this knife to be a dangerous weapon without any proof in the record that it's a dangerous weapon. And so cases are reacting to PDF, and that's why defense or prosecutors were calling police officers to testify about a knife. And yes, in SML case, that police officer wasn't sufficient because that officer was talking about, well, we consider it dangerous, air quotes, because we see how it gets used all the time. We see stab victims. So he's talking about use. Knives are dangerous because of the way they're used, and that's what Judge Ross says in that opinion. And he rejects that. We're not talking about use here. We're talking about design because in this particular case, this is a school gun or a knife in a locker case, there's no use to rely on. Incidentally, there is another school gun or knife in a locker case where they spoke to the student, and the student said, yeah, I was going to stab that guy if he ever came near me again. Guess what? That was a dangerous weapon based on intended use, right? That's not design. That's intended use. This statute is a labyrinth. And so, and there's a lot of cases out there where people, where the opinion says something like, the manner in which it used was capable of causing great bodily harm or death. No. Designed, capable, use or intended use, calculated or likely. Whatever the difference may be there, there's a difference.
Need to remind you, your time has expired. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed and the arguments are helpful to us today. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you very much.